on your website, it says Braxton House.
Braxton House was the name of the record company that I formed about 8 years ago.
Yes.
But at this point, Braxton House is stalled. My marriage broke up about 8 years ago, and suddenly life became complex, and it was impossible to continue with Braxton House. My hope for the future is to resurrect Braxton House, but that will take another 5 years or so before I'm in a position where I can start to think about rebuilding the record company.
Right. Did you produce any discs on the label, Braxton House?
Braxton House has something like 8 or 9 CDs out.
Okay. All Anthony Braxton CDs?
Yes.
Right. And you say, like, Braxton House is an attempt to build something for myself to respond to the challenge of the third millennium.
Yes.
What's the challenge?
Well, that's a dynamic question. The challenge of the third millennium, each person looks at the forward space, and for myself, when I think about the third millennium, I as a young guy, for instance, the year 2000 was considered the future. Actually, the year 1984 was, for my generation, a point of definition that recognized that we had crossed into a new time and space, into the future. And the third millennium would be the post-future, and the hope of global unity, the hope of a transformational spiritualism, the hope of renewed exploration of the cosmos, the hope of humane and restructural science. For myself as a musician, the hope and challenge of learning about global creativity as a way to continue to move towards unifying our species and getting past the idea of isolated national boundaries. And yet, of course, we now find ourselves in a time space where there are many conflicts, and of course my country would unilaterally attack Iraq. For this reason, I was very opposed to President Bush and voted for Senator Kerry. And so we now find ourselves in the third millennium in a way that is very different than what I would have hoped for. And but there's still the challenge to go through this time cycle and find a way to reunify. That reunification in many ways now has been thwarted by American foreign policy, but I would like to hope that somehow we can find a way to back away from the mess that has been opened up by President Bush's administration. For myself as a musician-composer, I continue to work from the same value systems I had as a young person, and by that I mean war or no war. I am committed as a musician to continue to evolve my music system and to continue to learn about the discipline of music. I feel that the discipline of music is the most powerful discipline to bring people together in the most positive sense, where it might be possible to continue with the dream of world unification. I realize, though, that the geopolitical dynamics of this time period have opened up a new set of complexities involving nation states and the dynamics of America, which in my opinion might be moving towards the same destiny that befell the Holy Roman Empire, which imploded in the middle before it was attacked from the outside. And right now in America, we have a divided country, almost split down the middle. And so the challenge of creativity in this context, in my opinion, involves being consistent and working towards the evolution of our species and to eradicate the emphasis on differences rather than similarities. And so the challenge of the third millennia, coming back to your question, the challenge of the third millennia is the challenge of Earth unification, the challenge of countries working together, finding common ground. And as a musician, the challenge is to continue to learn about Earth music. For myself, I see myself as a professional student of music. And by that, I'm saying that I try to continue to learn about the challenge of my discipline, that it has always been much greater than any one person. And I feel grateful that I was able to discover something that I could give my life to, that being the discipline of music and the spirituality of music and the role of music in evolution, scientific evolution, vibrational evolution, ritual evolution, and world unification.
Right. Talking of spirituality, did you ever go to India?
I had one opportunity to go to India about 15 years ago, but I became sick 2 weeks before the possibility could happen. And as a result of that sickness, I was not able to go. I have never been to India, but I have been interested in Indian culture and music for the last 40 years.
All right, okay. Okay, I hope you'll find an opportunity soon.
Thank you.
Yeah, actually, there's not a lot of jazz going on in India.
I'm not interested in jazz in India. I'm interested in Indian music,
exactly.
Indian culture. I think the great continuum of creative music from India is profound, and I have learned much from the great Indian masters, and I have more to learn from the great Indian masters.
Right. Okay.
Panelal Ghosh was one of my heroes. Panelal Ghosh, he's a flautist.
Yeah.
A very special flautist. I was very affected by his music. And of course, growing up in the time space of the 60s, I was very affected by Ravi Shankar and Alia Bakan. But at Wesleyan University, where I teach, we have a department sector that teaches Indian music. We have Indian masters coming to the university.
Okay.
And so I'm able to continue to learn about Indian music.
Okay, that's great. That reminds me that the first album that I ever heard of you was Wesleyan, 12 Alto Solos.
Oh, that was
yeah,
okay.
And I didn't like it at first.
Oh, that is normal.
Then I got back to it, and I thought, oh my God, I didn't like this. Ever since, I've been looking for more and more Anthony Braxton.
In fact, this was my first reaction when I heard John Coltrane. I remember thinking,
really?
This is not music. What is he doing? I don't want this. I want nothing to do with it. And as I was leaving the club, the musicians finished the last composition and proceeded to the next composition, which was a ballad. And the ballad was the composition, "It's So Easy to Remember, But Hard to Forget." And I'll never forget that when I listened to Mr. Coltrane play this ballad, and he played it so beautifully, I found myself totally perplexed, and I asked the question, how is it that Mr. Coltrane can play so beautiful on this ballad, but that the other musics were so abstract? And it was at that point that I decided to start to research this music and to better understand what was happening. And so I can relate to you when you say, oh, hearing the Wesleyan CD for the first time, it's very complex, because in America especially, the music is not exposed, people are not taught and educated about contemporary music. And so it becomes a cathartic experience that one has to go through before finding one's way inside of the music. This is the norm in this time period.
All right. Okay, great. And one more thing is the titles of your compositions.
The titles of my compositions came about in the middle 60s as I started to understand which way I wanted to go with my music, as I started to find myself. As a young guy, I grew up listening to Arnold Schoenberg, Stockhausen, and Xenakis, and Cage. And at the same time, I was very attracted to the music of Charlie Parker, John Coltrane, and Ornette Coleman, and Elbert Eiler, and Dave Brubeck. And I felt in the time space of the 60s that there was the possibility to begin to unify world musics. I felt this way because I did not have any natural opposition to world music. It was just the opposite. I was interested in world music. The titles then would come out of the decision to build a music system that was tri-centric. That is to say, every composition in my music system has a graphic visual title. Every composition has a coded title that's part of the esoteric component of the system. And every title has an opus number.
Opus number.
Opus number, that being the order of the composition. Number one, number two, number three, right, like that. I chose that approach because I was looking for a way to document a three-dimensional experience as opposed to a dialectical experience. The number three is the primary number in my system. That is to say, the number three to the third power is the generating number of the model that I have constructed for my music system. And so the titles also reflect that equation. The origin identity nomenclature, the secondary identity nomenclature, and the genetic or esoteric nomenclature.
Right. And Yeah, and I remember that there was some talk about you having difficulties about obtaining the copyrights or the money that comes from the copyrights because your compositions were titled like that.
Yes.
No, you did.
Yes, the first 15, 20 years of my work, I had many problems with the copyright people.
Right.
They did not like my titles.
No.
And I began at that point to emphasize for them the opus number titles as a way to have something that they could refer to clearly. Composition 20A, composition 40A, a number set that that BMI, for instance, would accept.
Okay. Right.
But as a young guy, I wasn't thinking in terms of any of that. As a young guy, I wanted to define the components of my music system. And I, of course, was looking for to build a system that would help me to understand me, that would help me to understand the other, and that would provide a bridge into the vibrational implications and spiritual and ritual implications of the work that I wanted to do. And so all of those intentions would be expressed in the titles as well.
Right. So that means now the problems are resolved.
Well, I don't know if it's resolved, but I have been consistent with the work I have initiated for the last 40 years. And if the problem is not resolved, it's really my fault because I've never really been a great business person.
No.
And I still have much to learn about being more accountable in terms of business. I've always found the business of the music to be complex for me. I tend to think more about music rather than business.
Right. Okay. And it looks like you're the only one who has the system of music. Is it true? Are there other people who are following the system or who have their own system similar?
Leo Smith has designed a system. We were, as young guys, we were very much aware that that the breakthroughs in the time space of the 60s represented an opportunity to build something that that could assist the evolution of creative earth music in the third millennium. And so Leo Smith would be an example of a musician colleague who was very interested, like myself, in building not just playing music or playing concerts, but to build a concrete system of music that could offer alternative experiences and connections. There are others, people like George Lewis.
George Lewis. George Lewis.
He's one of the
brilliant. George Lewis, the trombonist.
Yes.
Oh, yes, yes. I was just talking to my colleague who does the show with me about George Lewis, that he's a great musician, but we don't find many of his recordings. Like, I have just a few.
Yes.
With Steve Lacy. But he's recorded some CDs with you, I think, some records. Some records.
We have projects documented, and George also has projects of his own. I think he's another example of a musician who has chosen to evolve his work in a particular kind of way.
Right.
And I have a real respect for him.
Right. He lives in Paris, doesn't he? Or somewhere in France.
Right now he lives in New York, but he did have a period of living in Paris.
Okay.
All of us
Ran
to Paris because we fell in love with France in the 60s.
Right.
And so Paris and France will always be special to me.
Exactly. And that brings me to the question of BYG. I was reading an interview of Sidney Murray. Did you ever have a chance to play with Sidney Murray?
Oh yes, he's an old friend.
Okay. And he called the BYG people gangsters. They never gave you your money. Do you agree?
BYG is consistent with the political and business structure that musicians like myself deal with regularly. This is a structure that has been politically created, a structure that contains a very different economic reality than the classical structure. And BYG Records is in the tradition of the possibilities for musicians like myself. That is to say, that BYG is a gangster company doesn't really give the listener clarity. In fact, BYG is similar to 80%, 90% of the companies that musicians like myself deal with as part of the norm.
Okay, so they're just one of the...
One of the many.
Okay. All right. Okay. And did you enjoy your time with the... like you say, you enjoyed your first... When you came to Paris, you enjoyed the time. Did you enjoy recording for BYG?
I was grateful that they gave me an opportunity to document my music. I come from a poor family. I don't come from money. And when I came to Europe the first time, I had a one-way airplane ticket and $50 in my pocket. And I came to Europe to fight for my music and to meet the European musicians, to learn from what they're doing and work with them, and to begin to discover the greater reality that is impossible to experience if you only stay in America. I was interested in the world, and so as a young man, I came to Paris with basically no money, and I was grateful that BYG would give me opportunities to document two projects. It's true that I was not able to make very much money, but the documentation itself was important.
Yes, very important. Exactly. And okay, and how's Lucy? Did you finally get an opportunity to trade it in?
No, I still have Lucy.
You still have it?
Oh yes.
Really?
I'm working for this tour. I'm using Lucy 3,
okay.
But I'm still working with my basic instruments.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. Do you ever play them like in the original one in concerts?
I have not played Lucy 1 in a concert in, say, maybe 15, 20 years. For the last 15, 20 years, I've been playing Lucy 2, but last year I had a tour in Europe, and I came over for the tour, but I forgot my alto saxophone. So I went to Selma and bought a new saxophone.
Right.
So now I have Lucy 3, and I'm playing Lucy 3 on this tour.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yes, I was there for the concert last night. It was a beautiful concert. Beautiful concert.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And I just wanted to ask you, what did you play? What's the name of the composition?
The composition we played last night was composition 341. 341. Yes, 341.
Can I borrow your pen?
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much. Composition... 341.
Okay. And composition 341 represents a new prototype that I refer to as the accelerator class of the ghost trance musics. That is to say, the prototype ghost trance musics, which I developed about 10 years ago, has three species, and the accelerator class prototypes is a derivation from the third species musics. And so last night we gave the first performance of the new accelerator class ghost trance prototypes.
Right. Can you illustrate it?
Well, I'm not sure if I can illustrate, but let me.
Right.
If I were illustrated, it would look like
Oh, that's getting complex. Oh, I've seen these before.
This is first species. Bop, 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 metric pulses.
Right.
Second species is metric pulses with abruption. So it'd be pop, 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 doo, pop, 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 doo, pop, pop, pop. And last night we played the third species, accelerated class, and the third species is like the difference being from strict metric pulse to metric pulse with abruption and finally to irregular line forming logics.
Okay.
That would be one way of looking at it.
Right, right. Okay. Well, I understand some of it, but technically, frankly, I don't understand anything about music.
Oh, yes. Well, but visually, you can look at it as a straight.
I understand that.
Yes.
Yes, I understand that.
So it's like pop, 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 pop.
Right.
A continuity of pulses.
Right.
A continuity of pulses that shifts.
Exactly.
And finally, imbalance continuities, where it's never repeated in the same
right.
tempo, but it's shifting tempos.
Right. In fact, Mr. Braxton, I realized that I don't understand anything about music, but if I followed this, if I looked at this, if I studied this more, I might.
Oh, yes, because my music is also connected to a image logic base.
Right.
And so visual artists are able to look at the compositions and see the image logic inside of the music as well.
Exactly. Right. Well, are you a mathematician?
No, not really, but the dynamics of music composition becomes part of mathematics anyway. And so I'm interested in architecture and mathematics as part of the challenge of composition and the challenge of understanding what the concept of identity means in the third millennium. The concept of identity as a trans-idiomatic phenomena rather than the idea of playing bebop for 50 years or playing Schoenberg for 50 years or Bach for 50 years. In the third millennium, the creative musician works through different idioms. And this has been one of the major changes that came about because of the work of the AACM, where before the AACM, the jazz musician would think of himself as a jazz musician that plays with bass drums and piano every project. But after the AACM, we began to see the emergence of what I now refer to as the creative musician, interested in creative music, crossing idiomatic borders. So I'm as interested in Indian music as I'm interested in march music or the American song form tradition. That is to say, I'm interested in exploring different propositions, different states of architecture, of sonic architecture.
sonic architecture. Hmm. And about the AACM, what's your place in the AACM now at the moment?
A very good question. I've been separate from the AACM really for the last 20 years. I no longer live in Chicago. I live in Middletown, Connecticut. There is an AACM chapter in New York, but I'm 59 years old, and more it's impossible to work from the framework of an organization. I do my own music at this point. I'm no longer a young guy, 20 years old, working with young guys fighting to find my music. I'm 59 years old, and I've been doing my work for 40 years. I have total respect for the AACM, and I have come to learn that there are, at this point, two generations of new musicians who have come up through the AACM. Many of these people I have never met. I still feel that the AACM is an important organization. But for myself, at this point, I'm doing my own music. And I was trying with Braxton House and with the Tri-Centric Foundation to create my own structure. I wanted to build, and I still want to build, a structure where I can evolve my work and also help the young musicians to produce their musics and their concerts in the way that I was taught from the AACM. And so this most certainly remains one of the challenges for me in the third millennia, in the coming years. That is to find a way to continue my work and find a way to work and help the younger musicians.
Right.
That's part of my responsibility.
Has the music of the AACM or the musicians coming out of the AACM, are they any different from the musicians that you were at your time? Like, is there a lot of difference?
A good question, but it's a question that I can't answer because I'm not as familiar with the music of many of these people. I can't talk intelligently about their music because I haven't heard much of this music. My sense of it is that things have become maybe a little more conservative than what I would have hoped for, but the times have changed. In the end, I don't have enough information to have an intelligent viewpoint about it.
Right, yeah, about music becoming conservative. I've read about it and heard talk about it, yes.
Well, in America right now, there is a neoclassic movement,
right.
And this neoclassic movement, in my opinion, is connected with the antebellum Christian activist movement that George Bush is part of. And that movement, in my opinion, is seeking to put every component back into its quadrant space as defined, say, 100 years ago. The black community must be with the black community. The white community must be with the white community. The Indian community must be with the Indian community. The jazz musicians must play just jazz. And it must be jazz from Louis Armstrong to 1960. Anything after 1960, they say, is not jazz. And they might be right. I don't consider myself a jazz musician. I'm not interested in jazz. I'm interested in music. And I'm not interested in the yoke of jazz. The yoke of jazz as a way of saying, as a way of being confined to the jazz reservation. I'm not interested in that. I've always been interested in earth music. And so going back to America in this time period, the neoclassic movement in my opinion, is part of a reductive process that's been taking place for the last 15, 20 years, a reductive process that seeks to reshift the music back into the psychology of the 20th century. And with that shift, to re-emphasize the ethnic quadrant specifications of the music at the expense of the universal qualities of the music. I view this continuum as consistent with American political reality in this time period and the Christian activist movement. And while I respect their right to advance their work within their value systems, for myself, I have tried to separate myself very clearly from that movement, because I am I'm not a jazz musician, and I'm not interested in ethnic quadrant reality as a basis for my own work. I'm interested in the world and in composite reality. And so, going back to your question, the music that we call jazz in this time period seems to be conforming to the general cultural tendencies in America in this time period. Tendencies which I'm not in agreement with. I'm not in agreement with the decision to invade Iraq. I'm not in agreement with the decision of my country to be separate from the Kyoto agreements. I'm not in agreement with the idea that the United States of America can unilaterally attack a country and not go through the United Nations. I feel that the way events are going in this time period, that in the next 10 to 30 years, we will see the emergence of China as the main superpower. As far as I'm concerned, the fall of the Soviet Union would be a point of definition in the imbalances which have occurred in the last 15, 20 years. Imbalances in American foreign policy, imbalances in American arrogance, imbalances in American geopolitical manipulation. I feel that the greatest challenge to America will be the next 10 to 30 years. Will America find a way to correct itself, or will America go the way of the British Empire or the Holy Roman Empire? Thus far, my hope is for my country to correct itself, because I love my country. But my feeling is that unless America can be more humble, unless America can see itself as part of the composite nations on this planet and not superior to the nations of this planet, America will have a complex future. This is my feeling.
Complex future. Right. How about the... I think it's having a complex present, isn't it? It's having a complex present time.
This is a very complex time that in many ways, for me, harkens back to the time space of the 1960s when America had misadventures in Vietnam. There are many parts of America, and this was reflected in this last election. One part of America, I feel, is dynamically positive and brilliant. We have the young people who can do the job. We have every reason to have hope for the future. But there's another part of America that emphasizes multinational connections. There's the organized religion component, the activist Christian component. There are the attempts to reseat America in the early psychologies. And in many ways, America is now moving back towards the medieval period, a period that's analogous to the medieval period right now. So it's very interesting and exciting, but it's also, for me, it's complex because I love my country, but in the end, many mistakes are being made in this period. And I feel that the Bush administration has really brought us to the religious war prophesied by Armageddon concepts. And this will be a different experience from the Vietnamese experience. I think this is the most dangerous time in our country's history since the Civil War, I feel.
Coming back to music and musicians.
Yes.
What do you think about Rahsaan Roland Kirk?
Rahsaan Roland Kirk was one of the great restructural masters of the fifth restructural cycle. I was fortunate as a young man to have opportunities to play music with him and to talk with him. In fact, my first performance in New York City was with Rahsaan Roland Kirk. So I was very fortunate to have opportunities to meet him and to play with him. And I was also able to have an opportunity to play music with him 3 or 4 months before he died. There was a concert at Radio City Music Hall, and I had an opportunity to see the great Rahsaan Roland Kirk played some of the most incredible music I've ever heard in my life. And he only had one hand, and he was still playing multiple saxophones. And he was equal to anybody that I had heard. I think he is one of the unsung heroes of American creative music.
And did you ever play with John Coltrane?
No, I never played with Mr. Coltrane, although I had a possibility to play with him at the Plug Nickel in Chicago, but I did not feel I was good enough, and I felt it would be disrespecting my hero to go on the stage and play with him, even though I witnessed saxophonists who should have been my students who went and played with Mr. Coltrane. But it was okay. Each person has to make their own decision. But to answer your question, John Coltrane, well, his music was a spiritual force in my life. And meeting him as a person only reconfirmed that this was a very special man, a spiritual man who had a vision for the future. A spiritual vision of unity for humanity. He has been an inspiration for me for over 40 years, Mr. Coltrane.
That's wonderful. All right. And you read a lot.
Oh, yes, I read too much. I teach at the university, so I'm constantly researching, but this is part of what my life is about. I was interested in music as an experience. I was interested in music as a science. I was interested in music as part of the theoretical components. I was interested in music as a way of understanding human history, and as such, I spend a great deal of time researching and reading, and I see that as part of my work. I make no separation between
music as an experience, scholarship, and the esoteric components of the music as related to ritual and ceremonial manifestations.
And do you ever read poetry?
In this period, I have not been reading poetry, but as a young guy, I was very interested in poetry. I was very interested in Baudelaire. I was very interested in E.E. Cummings, for example. But and I was also very interested in Amiri Baraka as a young man. In this time period, I have not been reading very much poetry. Working in academia, most of my reading is directed towards the subject of the classes of the semester, and doing research in that way.
What do you think about Langston Hughes? I'm sure you're familiar with his work.
Langston Hughes, in fact, there's a wonderful duo he did with Charlie Mingus.
Yeah, exactly.
And when I do my Mingus class, I try to have my students not only listen to it, but to also research Mr. Langston Hughes's work as well.
Right.
But yes, Langston Hughes was an influence when I was a younger guy.
Right.
I have not thought about his work so much in this period in time, but his work is a part of me as well.
Right. And Jack Kerouac.
I've always respected Mr. Kerouac as an example of the existential polarities of the 1950s. His work is directly connected to the breakthrough of Charlie Parker and the occult movement of bebop. It would be in that time space where the concept of the hippie would start to form, or the concept of the isolated individual like James Dean or Jack Kerouac, and the poets who use jazz as a stimulant for their work. Mr. Kerouac's work is connected to that whole period.
Right. And how do you feel about it? What do you, about Jack, how you like it, you don't like it, or?
I respect every creative artist's right to do their work. In the case of Kerouac, he was a complex guy, but he did his work. And that's all I'm concerned about. Each person has to try to do the best they can do with their life. The only thing that I'm opposed to is the idea of not doing anything, of not fighting for your life. I think it's important, or it's been important for me, to feel that I'm doing the best that I could do with the situation I was born in and try to improve my life. I support anyone who's been able to complete something or build something.
And we hear a lot about Anthony Braxton and his music, but we don't hear a lot about Anthony Braxton, the man, the family man.
Well, that's because I have no family right now. My marriage just broke up.
Yes. Do you have any kids?
I have four children.
Right.
But this is not the best time for me and my children. I'd like to hope for a rapprochement with my children, but since the breakup of my marriage, my family life has been very complex. Not only that, I'm originally from Chicago, and I have always been viewed as somewhat separate, even in my own family when I was growing up. And so as far as my personal life, I have been very fortunate in my life. But if the subject is my family, I love my family. But this is a complex subject. I have not, for instance, had what one would call storybook life with everything in place. In fact, my life has been a struggle. And I say that not to complain. In fact, I have had a very fortunate life. But if the subject is Anthony Braxton, the man, and his family, I would say, oh, complex subject.
Complex subject, yes.
I love my family, and I love them best when I don't see them much.
Right, right. Okay. And is music still a lot of struggle?
Music is, at this point in my life, I mean, it's, I can't talk of my arm as a struggle. I can't talk of my ear as a struggle. Music, at this point in my life, is part of how I breathe. This is what I do. I am 24 hours a day, I'm thinking about music. And there's always something new to learn. There's always something new to work on. I feel very grateful to be in a discipline that I can keep learning. And so, to answer your question, no, there's always something new to do. And I'm very excited about music in the same way I was when I was 11 years old.
Right. When do you start?
Maybe I'm even more excited.
Right. Exactly. All right. And in your liner notes for alto, you said something about the jazz critics. I sometimes think about the future of jazz magazines. I don't really understand what's happening with the jazz critics. Unless that avenue can be corrected, creative musicians will always be suppressed. How do you think the critics are behaving these days?
I think, as a young man, that statement is something I stand behind today. I think that jazz criticism is connected to the jazz business complex. And by that I'm saying, when I think about American history and American progressionalism, going back to the early 1900s, if the music that we now call jazz had been accepted by the American experimental tradition, I think we would have seen and would see now a more intelligent perspective as far as how the music is talked of. But that was not to be, and jazz would be used as part of the popular music mechanisms in the 1900s. That would create a problem. The jazz critics, as far as I'm concerned, in many ways can be looked at as controllers who are controlling who's going to be successful and from what terms. And it has really become, in my opinion, part of the ethnic-centric controlling mechanisms. Why am I saying that? Well, one, jazz is being defined as Genesis African-American music, when in fact it's a music that came together because of Africa and Europe. And but the European component of jazz has been downplayed because jazz is really a specially created area that allows for African-American participation in a controlled space. And the problem of this approach is that musicians like myself are not able to have their work looked at from a universal perspective, but rather it's in a kind of a ghetto that has been worked out in terms of value systems. There has been, in the past 15 years, the creation of a false canon from Louis Armstrong to Miles Davis that serves the African-American middle class, but it doesn't serve them well. And I'm in disagreement with the African-American community, the jazz community. I'm in disagreement with the American political machinery. And so your question about jazz critics and my comment 30, 40 years ago is still valid for me. I feel that musicians like myself are being held captive in a little reservation that's called jazz. But John Cage and Stockhausen are looked at as contemporary musicians, composers, and of course they are great. I have learned from these guys. But Leo Smith is also great. Cecil Taylor is great. Arnold Coleman is great. But their musics are viewed within the context of jazz. And as a result, we get cryptic interpretations that satisfy the definition spectra of jazz, but collides when viewed with a composite reality.
What would you like critics to call it? Like, if you were a critic, what would you call it?
Music. I use the expression creative music, because creative music is trans-idiomatic. Creative music is not America's property. America doesn't own creativity, and America is not the only country that's creative. So we need a new set of definitions that can help our citizens begin to see the similarities that unify us as people. Creative music, in my opinion, is a third millennial term that is inclusive for musicians who are approaching their work separate from the marketplace variables. Jazz is not the only creative music. There are many creative musics. I'd like to hope in the next 10, 20 years that we will have a fresh perspective about the wonder of human creativity. And inside of that perspective, the term creative music is a loose enough term that can be employed by musicians in Indonesia, in China, in India, and in America. Because we are, whether or not we want to face it, we are in a global reality situation now. The television set, the telephone, the internet, anything that happens on the planet, we learn about it immediately. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see these new advances incorporated in a new set of definitions.
Yes. And the liner notes, you mentioned also Bobby Bland. And you hope to, you said someday you will record a blues album. Did you get around to it?
I have not gotten around to, at present, doing a total blues project. But I did have opportunities to meet Mr. Bland. And about 25, 30 years ago, in Boston, we played opposite one another, and the Bobby Blue Bland ensemble came to listen to us, and then my ensemble came to listen to Mr. Bland. He's always been one of my heroes.
Okay.
He's a very wonderful man. He was a very wonderful man.
Yeah. Right. Okay. All right. Well, I didn't know about your fascination for, like, we hear about John Coltrane, that Anthony Braxton refers to John Coltrane and other musicians, but never Bobby Bland. It was these liner notes that gave me this information.
Okay.
Yeah.
I am interested in music.
Yeah. Now I understand.
And Bobby Blue Bland is part of my past. I have always loved his music. But I love Johnny Mathis and Frank Sinatra. I like march music. I like organ skating music, Indian music. It doesn't matter. I'm a student of music. I try to learn from music and respect the different musics, country music, rock music. I just discovered a group called Wolf Eyes, and it's a noise band, a trio. They are fantastic. And my hope is that I can learn from the young musicians who are coming up now, because they're doing different things. To be serious about music, in my opinion, means to stay open to learn. And so Bobby Blue Bland is in Muddy Waters, and that whole Chicago blues continuum is part of my past, as much as the music of Johann Sebastian Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart. And I love their music.
And talking about the rock and rollers, who do you really like, or who do you like?
In this time period?
Yeah. Or from the masses like Little Richard?
When I was growing up, it was Little Richard, Bill Haley in the Comets, The Impressions. Oh my God, it was Smokey Robinson, the great man, Diana Ross.
And there was Elvis.
There was Elvis. I wasn't exactly into Elvis as a young guy, but as I got older, I came to understand how Elvis's music fit into the total picture, and I have a total respect for Elvis Presley. He was an original, and I have always gravitated towards and respected musicians who have originality. And so Elvis Presley is definitely someone I respect.
Right. I started listening to music with Elvis Presley.
Is that right?
Yeah. Elvis Presley, Frank Sinatra. Yeah.
Well, I saw him when he first came on television in America.
Oh, really?
I remember. Oh, yeah.
Ask.
And he was...
shaking his hips.
He was the camera would not show the hips.
Exactly.
But
that.
He was electric and radiant as a young man. And he was an original from the beginning to the end. And for me, this is what I'm interested in. I like the musicians who go their own way and do their music the way they want to do the music, and who are not pushed to do something that they don't want to do. Now, Elvis had a complex career, and his manager, the Colonel, certainly brought strange projects to Elvis. But even so, Elvis Presley is a great creative music master, and he has left a body of work that's diverse and beautiful. And I salute him.
That's great. Have you ever said that before in an interview?
I don't think I've ever been asked about Elvis Presley before.
Right. Okay, and this is a question about an unfindable record that my partner asked me to ask you about. It's a record that you made with Willem Brecker in 1969.
Oh, yes.
And it's on CBS.
Oh, it's on CBS?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
No? Okay. Because actually...
I'd like to buy it. I don't...
Really?
Yes.
All right.
I don't have a copy of it at this point.
Okay.
But when I first came to Paris, I went with Gunter Hampel up to Amsterdam and met Willem Brecker.
Right.
And we did the session. And Willem Brecker is another example of a great creative music master from my generation who is an original. And this is what I like about Brecker. He found his own way, and his music doesn't sound like anybody else's. That, to me, is the essence of artistic achievement, to find your own music and to build upon it. And Willem Brecker continues to build upon his music. I respect him completely.
Right. And a quintet that you're playing with currently now, like yesterday, has it been in existence long or not?
I have played with these musicians in different situations. This is the first coming together of these musicians as a group. And my plan is to do more projects with this group. I'm enjoying working with this group. They are incredible musicians and wonderful people. And it's very exciting and challenging to play music with these people.
And I was surprised last night that they that they are so, they look so relatively young.
Well,
especially the guitarist.
Yes, Mary, she must be around 23 or 22 or something.
Right.
And this is very good for me, though. I need to, at 59, it's important to connect with the younger generation.
Right.
And give them opportunities for experience, and also learn from them. And so I, again, I see this as part of my responsibility to give opportunities to younger musicians, especially when there are good musicians like Mary Halverson. In fact, Mary studied with me. She's one of my students.
Okay, at Wesleyan.
At Wesleyan.
Right.
And Taylor's one of my students.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
And Chris Dahlgren.
Okay.
But when I say they're one of my students, I'm also saying I'm one of their students. Because as far as I'm concerned, this idea that the teacher has all the knowledge and the student has no knowledge, I'm not interested in that idea. I think everybody can learn from one another. And so when I teach my students, I become their student as well. And we learn from one another. That way I can keep learning.
Right. Keep learning, indeed. And do you have any favorite saxophone players from the contemporary saxophone players? Are there any that you specially like?
There are many saxophonists that I respect. Roscoe Mitchell, Joseph Jarman, Henry Threadgill, Peter Broxman.
That's the generation, like, those are the musicians from your time.
Yes.
Right.
But you mean before that?
No, after that, the new generation.
The new generation. Well, there's Ken Vandermark.
Yes.
Matt Gustafsson. Jackson Moore.
Jackson Moore.
There's a young man named James Fay.
James Fay, yeah.
These people are extraordinary musicians and extraordinary saxophonists. I'm very excited by their work.
Right. And recently there's been a box set of Albert Eiler records.
I'm trying to get it. I don't have it.
You don't have it?
I will have it when I get home, though.
Right.
I will, once I get home, I will start to hunt this down.
Right.
It's 10 CDs out here.
It's 10 CDs, yes. And
I must have it.
Yes, yes, yes. I think it's a beautiful documentation of the Albert Eiler music that was not out before.
Yes.
Yes.
Albert Eiler has always been one of my heroes.
Really?
The first time I heard him, I understood that his music would have a profound effect on my life.
Did you ever meet
him? And it has. Yes, I had a chance to meet the great man. Only one time.
Yes.
And he was very nice. He was a very nice man.
Right.
And suddenly, a month later, mysterious death. But I was fortunate enough to actually meet the great Albert Eiler.
And Eric Dolphy.
I never met Mr. Dolphy. I missed the only concert that I could have attended, but I did not realize Eric Dolphy was playing with the group. In 1966, somewhere around there, Orchestra USA of John Lewis played at the University of Chicago. And at the time, I did not know Eric Dolphy played with them.
Right.
Later, two or three days after the concert, one of my friends said, "Oh, Anthony, you should have come to this concert. There was a strange saxophone player. It seemed like he played wrong notes, but I think you would have liked him. His name was Eric Dolphy." I said, "Eric Dolphy." It was my only opportunity to hear him live, and I missed it. and I regret it, but I did not realize that he was with Orchestra USA.
Yeah, sorry about that. I have that record. It's a beautiful record.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yes, yes,
yes.
Right. And, yeah, do you speak French?
A little functional French. Not good enough, but I can order a hamburger at McDonald's.
How would you order that?
Oh.
No. Okay,
off the record. Off the record.
No, I won't go there.
All right. Let me... Do we have time?
We can go a little longer.
Okay, okay. Please, please...
Yes.
Ask me to shut my trap when I... All right, I've... musicians... Oh, yes. I'm really surprised how little the musicians know about each other. That's you writing in your liner notes. Or what each other is doing. But maybe, someday, that might be corrected. Has it been corrected?
I don't think so. I think the musicians, for the most part, tend to isolate themselves, and as we get older, we become more involved with our own work. But I think it's important, whenever possible, to look around and see what other people are doing. But this is not always the case. I think in many cases the musicians are still isolated from one another. And so you have the African-American musicians playing in one space, you have the European-American playing in one space, you have the modern classical composers only doing their music but knowing nothing about what they think jazz is, and the jazz people know nothing about opera. It's changing slowly, but it's very slowly.
Yeah. And does this phenomenon, like musicians not knowing about each other, is it, like, does it exist in one kind of music, one genre of music, like jazz? Jazz musician, one jazz musician does not know about...
No, I think it goes across the board. I think the classical musicians have the same problem. You have classical musicians who only play the classical repertoire of Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart, but they know nothing about Schoenberg or Stockhausen or Cage.
Contemporary musicians.
Yes, and so this kind of narrow tunnel vision, I would like to hope that in the future it will open up, but it's a slow process.
Slow process, yes. Well, I've asked you most of the questions that I've prepared.
You are very good questions. It's been wonderful to have a chance to talk with you, sir.
Really? Thank you so much.
Yes, and your English is really clear. I admire people who are really proficient in different languages like yourself.
Thank you so much. I speak only English and French and Hindi.
Oh.
I come from India.
Well, you come from a great culture if you come from India.
Right, and I'm... Maybe, shame on me, when I was in India, I was never interested in the classical, Indian classical music.
Oh, it's life. I mean, I was never interested in the blues-centric logic as a young man, because everyone said that I had to be interested in it, and I didn't want to do what everyone said I had to do. I wanted to only listen to what I wanted to listen to.
Right.
And this is... This is the norm. So if you come from India, you tend to not notice the great musics happening all around you because you've grown up with it.
Right.
Then you go
exactly.
away, and then you discover, oh, actually, it's better than what I knew when I was growing up.
Exactly.
That it's really important.
Right.
This is a normal part of human experience.
Right. Yes. And yes. Talking about the blues, how about Robert Johnson?
Oh, I try to include several classes on Mr. Johnson's work when I'm teaching history of African American music.
Right.
No, Robert Johnson was very important.
Right. Would you like to have a draft of water?
Oh no, I'm fine. I'm fine.
Okay. And do you ever record with the AEC Art Ensemble of Chicago?
No, we've never recorded together. I played with the Art Ensemble when they first came to Paris. And, of course, we all grew up together, and so we did hundreds of projects in Chicago. But I have no documentation to my knowledge, of any of the projects that we've done together.
No. I've recently acquired Alone Together, you with Joseph Jarman.
Yes, that was one of the earlier projects.
Exactly. The duo albums, I especially like your duo albums, like with the recent one with Leo Smith.
Thank you.
And Joseph Jarman.
Thank you.
That's an old one. Do you ever record in duo with Rascal Mitchell?
Oh, yes, we have a duo on Sackville Recordings. I don't think it's on CD at this point. But yes, Rascal and I, we have done many duos together, and I'd like to hope one day that the Sackville recording will come out, and also that maybe some of the live concerts we did will one day come out. We have played many duo concerts in the last 40 years, not so much, say, in the last 10 or 15 years, but as younger guys, we had many duo experiences, especially live performances. I'd like to hope one day some of that material will come out.
Right. Okay. It's all been recorded.
Much of it has been recorded. Whether it will come out in my lifetime is another question, but much of it is recorded.
Right.
We don't own the tapes, but the tapes exist.
Right. Okay. Right. And about Marilyn Crispo?
I saw Marilyn about 3 weeks ago in Sweden. It was the first time we've come together in a while. She was playing solo. She was playing with a quartet, and I had a solo concert. I think Marilyn Crispo is one of the great musicians of this time period. She's a super virtuoso. She's a very wonderful person, and she's a wonderful musician, and old friend.
Right. So what do you think about the evolution of her music after the time that she was playing with you in the quartet?
I think her music has gotten deeper. It's gotten more lyrical. I think she is really in the heart of her music at this point in her life. And plus, she's always growing. She's quite a virtuoso pianist. She can do anything. And so I try to keep aware of her work because she has limitless potential.
Do you sing, Mr. Braxton?
If I would sing, they would kick me out of France.
Will they? Okay. All right. Well, that's not true.
What is your name, sir?
Taran. Oh, yeah. I forgot to tell you my name. Yes, Taran. T-A-R-A-N.
Okay.
I'll give you my card. I'll just prepare these for the occasion.
No, let me say it's very nice to have a chance to talk with you. Thank you for your intelligent questions.
Thank you
for doing the kind of research where it makes sense to have an interview. Not everyone prepares on the level that you have prepared for this interview, and I thank you for respecting me enough to prepare before doing the interview.